We're still on the first chapter, and we were trying to see in what way the Gita needs to be studied. There are many ways in which the Gita has been studied and is being studied. And there are many scholarly studies, very academic studies, but this particular book deals with what may be called the living experience of the message of Sri Krishna in practical problems of human life. The question is, in what way Gita is contemporarily relevant? We all who belong to the present days, we are all confronted with certain specific problems. And we are in search of the solution of these problems. One of the problems with which Sri Aurobindo has started is the question of conflict of religions. Whether we like it or not, we are already in a field where different religions are in conflict with each other. And every religion comes forward to give a message and say that this message is the message, or else, even if there are other messages, this message is a better message or much superior message. Are we therefore also to say that this Bhagavad Gita is the message, or it is a superior message to any other message? Therefore, at the very beginning, Sri Aurobindo makes it clear that this is not the spirit in which we are going to turn to the Gita, nor has the Gita any pretension of making such a claim. In fact, the Gita has been presented as no other religious book has been presented in the world. The Gita is an episode. It's a part not of any religious scripture like the Bible or the Quran or even like the Vedas and the Upanishads, which are exclusively composed for a specific purpose, which we may call scriptural. But Bhagavad Gita has been cast into a framework of a battle and the scene also of a battlefield, where the hero comes to a sudden crisis, and it was in search of a solution to that crisis that the entire teaching of the Gita emanates. Therefore, it is not the spirit of the word Gita, or at least, it is not our spirit in which we are approaching the Gita to see the message or the supreme message. But we also can say that we belong to that category of people who, like Arjuna, are beset with a crisis. In fact, all of us, in our own times, are facing a very big crisis. And knowingly or unknowingly, we are a part of that crisis. So, like Arjuna, we also need to turn to somebody who can enlighten and who can give a guiding light. So it is in that spirit that we are turning to the Gita, not to make a scholastic study in which we ask questions as to what this particular word means or that word means, and what that scholar has said and what that scholar has said. We are trying to go to the Gita with our practical problem and try to find out if there is a living light which can give us the message that we require. It is as if we are going to meet Sri Krishna himself. And Sri Krishna himself does not deal with his problem in a scholastic manner in the Bhagavad Gita. Whatever opinions of other people he refers to are referred to only in the sense that they are necessary help. But Bhagavad Gita itself is not a book of scholarship. So, it is like meeting Sri Krishna himself in our own present day and turn to him to find out in what way he can elevate us, uplift us, and give a new light. Therefore, this entire book does not try to show that this is the message, the supreme message, the final message, and none other in the world. This is not the aim of this book at all. Secondly, Sri Aurobindo points out that we are actually in need of a synthesis. Our first point was that we are in a crisis and we are turning to the Gita to get some kind of an upliftment from this crisis. Not necessarily that we shall find a complete answer in it, because it is only an episode which is addressed to a particular situation. But we are open whether it gives us the complete message or no message, or partial message, or the relevant message, or the guiding message, or the helpful message. And the second point is that we are all today in a state not only of conflict of religions, but conflicts of various kinds. Even in the field of philosophy, there is a conflict. Different philosophical standpoints have come to sharp conflicts. In the field of philosophy and science, there is a conflict. Science and religion, there is a conflict. In fact, all disciplines of knowledge today are in need of some kind of synthesis. And we are living in an age where this problem of synthesis has to be faced. So this is the second context in which we are turning to the Gita. The need of synthesis of today, in what way can it be fulfilled by the Bhagavad Gita? So we shall turn to the Gita also with this question. Can Gita help us in arriving at a synthesis, resolution of conflict, not only of religions, but of all disciplines of knowledge? Now, it is in this context, and this is where we were last time, that Sri Aurobindo describes the present stage of mankind as that which stands at a threshold of a new synthesis. The need of a synthesis which requires a new synthesis, because there could be a need at some time to go back to the synthesis of the past, in which case our look at Gita would be quite different. We are today standing at a point where there is a need of a new synthesis. And that is because, as Sri Aurobindo says in the last paragraph, which is extremely important, last paragraph of the first chapter, where he says that we do not belong to the dawns of the past, but to the noons of the future. There is today, he says, a need to synthesize all the theistic religions of the world. Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, Judaism, all the theistic religions, then there is a need to synthesize religions with Buddhism, which is not theistic religion. Come here. So even religions which are not theistic, even they have to be synthesized. Then there is a new material which is now flowing upon us, new knowledge of science, that also has to be absorbed and assimilated. And ancient systems of knowledge and religions, which have been put into the background for a long, long period, but even they are being recovered. The meaning of the Veda, for example, which has been lost to our age, or even since ages, is now getting recovered. So even the Vedic knowledge and similar other knowledge of other traditions, the revelations of that knowledge also are coming upon us. Therefore, in the search of a new synthesis, our question is, can the Bhagavad Gita help us in arriving at a new synthesis of knowledge? Our very need is such that it cannot confine us to any kind of dogmatism. Right from the beginning, we are asking new questions and we are in need of new answers. Where the knowledge of the past or past systems of knowledge can help us, but they will not be able to give us the final answer because we are in need of a new knowledge. That is why Sri Aurobindo says that we have to recognize that in the past also there have been synthesis. Just as we are in need of a synthesis today, a new synthesis, in the past ages also there were periods when a new synthesis was necessary and new synthesis did come into existence, which were overpassed by new synthesis, and even those were passed over by new synthesis. And Sri Aurobindo himself describes at least 4 synthesis of the past, which came one after the other in the Indian tradition itself. The first is the Vedic synthesis. The second is a synthesis that we find in the Upanishads. Third is a synthesis of the Gita. The fourth is a synthesis of the Tantra. And now we are standing again at the edge of a new synthesis. But just as in the past, any new synthesis took into account the synthesis of the past, the earlier synthesis. Similarly, for building up a new synthesis today, we need to study all the past synthesis. We have to learn the synthesis that was made in the Veda, the Upanishadic synthesis, the Gita synthesis, Tantric synthesis. But among all these synthesis, Sri Aurobindo says, the synthesis made by the Gita takes a most important place. There is a speciality of the Gita. And that gives us a kind of a new perception on the Gita. Among all the synthesis of the past, the synthesis which we find in the Bhagavad Gita is going to be extremely most helpful to us. And it is for that reason that we are turning to the Gita. There are many other contexts also in which we are turning to the Gita, and we shall see as we move forward. But for the moment, let us pause here. And this is where we were last time. I had described the synthesis of the Veda to some extent. and we were about to enter into the synthesis of the Upanishads. But let us revise a little and see last time what we did with regard to the synthesis that we find in the Veda. As we know, Veda is reputed to be Veda, which means knowledge. Therefore, we might say that Veda is a book of knowledge. Veda is also reputed to be Karmakanda. Now, this Karmakanda gradually came to be only a practice of ritualism. But basically, Veda is Karmakanda in the sense that it gives us the secret of work. What is work? As Sri Krishna will tell us also in the Bhagavad Gita, that we have to distinguish between karma, akarma, and vikarma. Now, this distinction actually we find in the Veda itself. So, it is the knowledge of karma, and the greatness of some of the great Vedic rishis was that they declare, we have achieved perfection in works. Some of the Vedic rishis in their pronouncements, they have declared, we have now achieved perfection in works. So they had reached a climax. So what is work? What is the secret of work? And what is the perfection of works? What is the meaning of it? When can we say we have reached the perfection of works? This is the knowledge. The secret is also in the Veda. The Veda is also a book of prayers. Every hymn is a hymn of prayer. It is upasana, is worship. Therefore, in the Veda, we find the earliest synthesis of knowledge, works, and devotion. Bhakti, karma, jnana. But that is not all. There are some great peculiarities of the Vedic search and Vedic synthesis. The Veda discovered the presence of gods. Now, when we speak of gods, the present modern mind gets repelled. Because belief in gods in modern times is supposed to be a result of primitive mentality. That is, because the religions developed in history, what is called polytheism got surpassed, overpassed, and there came gradually what is called monotheism. So it has come to be believed that monotheism is a superior religion and polytheism is a kind of a superstition. Only ignorant people can believe in gods. Only ignorant people can have what is called anthropomorphism. It's a long word. Anthropomorphism. A-N-T-H-R-O-P-O-M-O-R-P-H-I-S-M. Anthropomorphism. It comes from the word which deals with man. Anthropology, for example, is a study of man. So anthropomorphism is to regard God in terms of man. To believe that God behaves like human beings. You flatter God and you get some good results from God. That God is very pleased if you offer lots of offerings. And then he promises you that he will protect you whether you are right or wrong. Because you have approached God, therefore he is bound to be your advocate. And he will defend you as human beings do. Now, this kind of belief in God or gods is what is called anthropomorphism. So it is believed that polytheism is fundamentally anthropomorphistic. Human beings who were afraid of all kinds of things in the world came to believe that there are forces, beings, gods behind these things, behind the sun and the moon and the stars and the tides and the ocean and rains and everything. There are so many spirits, so many gods. And you can approach them. If it rains, you say to rain god, please don't rain because I have to cross the ocean now. So if you approach him and if you give good gifts to Indra, then he will stop the rains for you. Now, this is anthropomorphic view of gods. So, in the history of religions, as people became wiser and wiser, become more and more refined, they came to the conclusion that God is not of that kind. God is not anthropomorphic. That there is certainly a question of worship of God. But you worship God not because you want certain rewards or you want through his instrumentality punishment for your enemies. Not for that reason. But God is to be worshipped because he is himself worshipable. He is admirable. He is wonderful. As Muhammad says, to see God and not to fall in love with him is impossible. He is such a reality. If you just approach him, not for any particular benefit or anything of the kind, just to be with him is delight. So, now here you don't see God as anthropomorphic. God as he is in himself. Something that is supreme, wonderful, most beneficent, merciful, by his very nature. Even if you don't pray, it's not as if he's going to punish you. Even without prayers, he will do the best for you. Because that is his nature. He's most merciful by his very nature. Now, this is called a more refined concept of God. Therefore, in the light of this light of new monotheistic belief, polytheism has been discarded. Or has been conceived as something very inferior. Therefore, if you now tell the modern mentality that Vedas have this distinctive feature that it had discovered gods, then many people might tell you that you are talking of something primitive, barbaric, and something that has to be overpassed. But the kind of the discovery that Vedic rishis had made was not anthropomorphic. They had also discovered not only many gods but also God. Veda is not polytheistic only. It is also at the same time monotheistic. Ekam sat vipra bahudha vadanti. It says there are realities only one. But it is spoken of as many, in many ways. Therefore, the concept of many gods is not as if there are several prime ministers in the world and who are in conflict with each other and all of them are sovereign, ultimate authorities. But all these gods are cosmic powers of one divine. This is the discovery of the Veda, that there are many gods. And one does not need to be afraid of maintaining that there is no doubt such a reality of many gods. But these gods are all cosmic powers of one supreme reality. That is why Veda is not rightly called polytheistic. Although many people who read the Veda cursorily, they might say that this Veda is only polytheistic, barbaric, primitive. But if you read the Veda as a whole, the kind of knowledge of the gods that we have in the Veda is quite different. Again, they are not anthropomorphic in the sense that these gods are not as if they are purchasable by all kinds of bribes. If you worship the gods, it is again for the glory of the gods, their greatness in themselves, their powers. Again, there is another peculiarity of the gods of the Veda, that each god can perform the function of another god. And each god is supreme god himself. This is the complexity of the idea of the gods in the Veda. There are many gods. All of them are manifestations of one cosmic and supreme and transcendental reality of one god. Each god can do the functions of another. Gods can work together in a collectivity, Vishwedevaha. They may work individually. They may work one for the other. And each can stand for the Supreme God himself. Now, these are the special discoveries of the Vedic search. That such is the kingdom of the gods. It's not a polytheistic, ordinary kind of polytheism. The Veda goes even beyond and says that the divine is not only one, but he is the only one. It's not as if God is the one reality, the ruler of the world, which is another reality. But even the world itself is their very reality, which is called monism. Very peculiar kind of monism. So there is in the Veda polytheism, monotheism, even monism. And you will find also in the Bhagavad Gita the same. We shall come to it later on. Even the Bhagavad Gita speaks of many gods. It speaks of one God as a ruler. It also speaks of the one reality alone, of which all in the world is a manifestation. So there is only one reality, there is no other at all. Now, this was the discovery of the Vedic rishis. Now, having made this discovery, they found out that individuals can come into contact with gods, with one supreme god, and with one reality that is the only reality. Therefore, the interrelationship between man and gods and one god and the supreme, one single reality, the synthesis of all these is the Vedic synthesis. There is no book in the world which gives you this kind of synthesis. It's a very peculiar, unique synthesis in the Veda. This kind of synthesis has been put into background in the history of the world. Even the Upanishads, which come later on, and which in a certain sense continue the tradition, even the Gita, which continues that tradition to some extent, does not have that richness of the Veda, where all these are described in so much of detail. It is again when you come back to the Puranas that something of this polytheism and monotheism and monism is again to be found. But still, the height at which, the loftiness at which this synthesis was done is not to be found in the Puranas either. The supreme experiences, the highest experiences, the completeness of the experience of the reality has never been surpassed anywhere in the world. Now, this again is not a statement to show, therefore, this is the best and the highest and the most superior. It's a scientific fact. And it doesn't say, therefore, that there is nothing further to be done. Or there can be no other formulation, or there cannot be another revelation which is not in the Veda. We speak of the loftiness, but not of the depths, subtlety, complexity. The kind of subtlety and synthesis of knowledge that we find in the Upanishads is not in the Veda. Therefore, Upanishads have something more to give us which is not in the Veda. The kind of synthesis that we find in the Upanishads is not in the Veda. Therefore, we can't say Veda is alone to be done and now nothing else. And other things have not much value. It is not true either. The kind of synthesis that we find in the Gita is not in the Veda. Although Gita is supposed to be the summary of the Veda, the essence, quintessence of the Veda, as a quintessence is true, but the kind of synthesis that the Bhagavad Gita gives you, even of karma, jnana and bhakti, that kind of synthesis, that kind of formulation, that kind of depth, the supreme manifestation of karma yoga particularly, you don't find anywhere in the world, as far as that particular province is concerned, the supreme manifestation of karma yoga. So the peculiarity of the Gita is the knowledge of the integral karma yoga. That kind of synthesis is neither in the Upanishads nor in the Veda. Therefore, it is inevitable that if you really want to make a good grand synthesis, you have got to turn to the Upanishads, to the Gita. Because that is the knowledge which is given in the Gita. So, in the Veda particularly, what we find is the synthesis of man with God's Supreme God and the reality. And the highest and loftiest experiences of the divine. This is the peculiarity and speciality of the Veda. There is a further speciality of the Veda. And that is that the human faculties, the faculties of the body, of the life, of the mind, of reasoning, ethicality, aesthetics, all these different faculties of man, each faculty is related to a corresponding Godhead. Corresponding God, in which that faculty is most manifestly perfect. If, for example, you are in search of perfecting your power of inspiration, then it is to be connected with Saraswati, that is one of the goddesses of the Vedic pantheon. Because Saraswati is perfect in inspiration. Not perfect in revelation. Not perfect in intuition. Not perfect in discrimination. But perfect in inspiration. So if you want to develop your inspirative power, power of inspiration, then you need to synthesize yourself with Saraswati. Although it is also true that Saraswati can function for intuition if necessary. It's not as if Saraswati is so exclusive that she keeps only one shop and nothing else. She can also open up the doors for Sarama, for Daksha, for Ila.
What does relating to a God mean?
Relating to?
God. Relating to.
How do you relate yourself? All relations can ultimately be spoken of in terms of threads. Every individual may be conceived as a knot of threads. And out of that knot, several threads spread out. Now these threads go on and on and on until they reach another knot. And there are so many knots, actually every individual, every one of us is a kind of a knot from which many threads are spreading out. And they are in turn tied up with another knot. If I am to be related to you, the threads that are passing through me or from me meet the threads that are passing from you. And the junction of these two create a special relationship. Now similarly, the threads of my powers of inspiration, which are very feeble in my case, now if they are allowed to spread out by an effort and reach where the threads of Saraswati are moving downwards towards the whole world, and if I can really tie up my threads with the threads that are coming from Saraswati, then the force of Saraswati will descend into me much more clearly, much more powerfully. And then with this infusion of the powers from Saraswati, I will become more and more inspired. So relating means only this: threads of powers coming out of your personality, out of your character, out of your aspiration, whatever you are, that complex, if these threads are spread more and more powerfully, then they can reach. This was the discovery of the Veda. How to relate yourself with the gods? And then how to receive from the gods the corresponding powers so that you can be united with them. Is it clear so far?
But does this mean that with those, when one's connected to those powers, are other knots with other relations also get loosened or straightened out?
It depends, yes. The more you are with some other forces, then other things suffer also. Therefore, there is a need of a synthesis. There is a whole science as to how to tie up yourself with all the gods, and then similarly, how to tie up yourself with other human beings, with the creatures of the world. Maybe your love for your cow is very great, your thread of relationship with your cow is very great. And how to harmonize your relationship with the cow, even while you are developing many other relationships with so many other forces, is also a problem of human life. And that also has to be considered and has to be solved. So there has to be from a given individual, a very vast network. And ultimately you reach a point of perfection where, you know, you become like a musician, where so many notes can be played by your hands, and you can combine, recombine, you can discombine, you can create new kinds of tunes and so on. So you become a musician in the world, as it were. Like Shri Krishna, if you see the Mahabharata, you can see what a great musician he was, that he could play upon any note of the world. There was not a single problem of the world which baffled him. He knew the right connections. He knew when Karna has to be approached, at what time. And he had found out all the knowledge that was regarding Karna. What is the secret of Bhishma? How Bhishma should be approached? He knew it very well. If you read only even from a human point of view, not Sri Krishna as an avatar, as a supreme being on the earth, in a human form, but merely as a human being. In fact, Mahabharata regards Sri Krishna both as a human figure and as an avatar. And you find both these elements mingled very beautifully in the Mahabharata. So if you see Mahabharata simply from the human point of view, how Sri Krishna works upon many fields, and he baffles everybody actually, he is not baffled. But whenever something happens, he is able to bring out the right knowledge, which is appropriate at that moment. That is why his enemies actually were extremely troubled by him. He was even criticized as a diplomat, as an intriguer, as a maneuverer, as somebody who tells one thing here, another thing there, and manipulates people, manipulates things, events, and so on. But that is because he's such a great musician. Wherever there's a need for anything, he's able to bring out the right tune at that right moment. He knows each one intimately. He knows Yudhishthira very well. Where is his weakness? And where is his greatness? Where is he obstinate? Where he will not agree? Where he will agree? And so on. He has made, even a human point of view, you can see that Sri Krishna had the widest and deepest knowledge of every important figure in Mahabharata. He knew each one very well. And how to deal with that person, he knew very well. That is because of the capacity of relationships. How to relate oneself with the others? In a certain sense, you might say that human life is nothing but a problem of relationships. And harmonizing relationships may be regarded as the problem of human life. In fact, Sri Aurobindo in his Life Divine, in the third paragraph of the first chapter, he says, all problems of existence are essentially problems of harmony. In one sentence, all problems of existence are essentially problems of harmony. So as I said, in the sense of relationships, the whole world can be regarded as nothing but a network of relationships. The knowledge of this network is what we may call the cosmic knowledge. If you know the network of all the knots in the world, all the threads in the world, how they are related, interrelated, it is a cosmic knowledge. And once, in fact, there is a kind of a consciousness which is called cosmic consciousness. And if you enter into that consciousness, you don't need to learn little by little as we now learn. To be in that state of consciousness automatically brings you the perception of cosmic harmonies and enables you also to work on this cosmic harmony. So what may seem to be extremely difficult now at a mental level may seem to be simple and straightforward once you enter into that consciousness. If somebody were to describe to you how a huge landscape appears and you read separate descriptions of all these landscapes, you find it so complex, so baffling, you may not understand the complexity of so many descriptions put together. But the moment you rise to the top of the hill and you look around, in a few seconds you know the whole. Then no more things look so difficult. Similarly, today if we are to be told, look, Indra has such and such threads of consciousness and such powers of relationships, Ashwins have got another, and Varuna has another, Mitra has another, Bhaga has another. We become so intrigued. But once you rise to that cosmic consciousness, everything becomes so simple. But this is the knowledge that we find in the Veda. And this is the greatness of the Veda. The Veda discovered varieties of complexities of gods, goddesses, human beings, and all the creation, entire interrelationship, entire network, and this network is not to be found anywhere in the world. Therefore, you might say, if you want to know the network, Veda is supreme. That is a scientific fact. Let us see if any other book gives you, you will salute it. There is no question. It's not as if we are dogmatic and say, oh, no, my Veda, therefore it must be the best and the highest. Not that. In the Veda, you find this knowledge. If any other book happens to be there, we shall be very happy. Let us read that also. So our attitude is not that this is the only thing and this is the best and the highest and now nothing more. It's not their attitude at all. But if you find in the Veda this knowledge, you have got to say there is no other book in the world which gives you this description. So what can you do about it? You have got to see it is the best and the highest. But as far as this is concerned, as far as this network of the cosmos is concerned, you can say that Veda gives you the most complex knowledge of the network of the world. And also tells you the secret by which you can come into contact with various gods, with various important centers of network, and how you can relate yourself with them, and how you can derive the power from that network. And it says there are two ways by which you can do, how you can relate. That secret is given, very simple, in words, although difficult to implement. First word is that each god can be invoked. There is a secret of invocation. Now, what is that invocation? They have found it's very simple actually. That they have given names to themselves. These gods have names of their own. If I want to meet Sarita, I can say Sarita, and I can immediately get into contact with her. It's only secret is only name, call, and the connection is established. It's so simple as that, basically. It is true even in the human world. If you know the name of somebody, then it's easy to contact. Even supposing, for example, I want to deal with a certain ministry of foreign relations. I want simply my visa, for example, very quickly. Then normally I say, whom shall I contact? And then if you find the name of the person, it's a great gain. If you know the name of that person, you can more easily contact him. Now similarly, in the Vedas, you have the names. For example, the word Indra is not an arbitrary name. It has a sound. Sound has vibrations. These vibrations are of such a nature that they really bring Indra himself connected with this name. The powers or the capacities that Indra possesses have a vibration, and these vibrations in terms of sound is Indra. The very word Indra is therefore a significant name. Now this was the discovery of the Vedic rishis. They did not arbitrarily give the name, this is Indra, this is Varuna, this is Bhaga. No. The words themselves have sound notations and sound power. And when you utter those words, they immediately bring you into contact with the corresponding god. Therefore, Veda is called a book of secret knowledge. Today, because we don't believe and we all throw it out in our modern arrogance and pride, is only at our price actually. But if you really want to come into contact, the Veda gives us those mantras which are addressed to Indra. Similarly, Agni, if you really want to come into contact with Agni, the word Agni itself is an invocatory word. The Vedic rishis were so great that they found out what are the vibrations, sound vibrations of these powers. Having got those sound vibrations, they gave the names accordingly. So the Vedic gods do not have arbitrary names. They have got real names, you might say. They are the real sounds. So that is the first secret of the Veda. The second is that every god demands a sacrifice. This is another method. Not only invocation, but also sacrifice. Now, actually, sacrifice is not properly understood. Sometimes it is said the sacrifice is a kind of a bribe. Anthropomorphic interpretation of sacrifice. It is said if you make a sacrifice, then God will be pleased and will give in return something that is His province. But actually it is not true. Sacrifice means the loosening of our threads of connections. If you want to connect yourself with Indra, for example, Indra is the power of light, just as Agni is the power of aspiration, just as Varuna is the power of wideness. So if you are in search of light, then the threads which are in me, which are so confusedly set in my being, which prevent the entry of light, that even if Indra wants to enter into you, you will prevent his entry into you because of the threads which are in a very confused network in your own being. So sacrifice means that you loosen your cobwebs. And your present limitations and simply expand them out. And as you go on expanding them out, the higher force will be able to enter into you. It's not a bribery that you give that, well, oh God, I'm giving you this kind of a sacrifice. I'll take 5 cows and give you in. It's not that sort of thing. It may have symbolic meaning, but that is not the real sacrifice.
No, but until then, the fasting, does it come in the category of sacrifice?
It depends. How, if it is connected with your, supposing somebody is very obese and eats a lot, then fasting may be very necessary for him, but not for you and for me. It may not be necessary at all. Because already the threads are loosened. We are not eating so much, so the threads are not thick at all. There's no cobweb. So you don't need to do it. All so-called sacrifice is nothing but a process of loosening our hard networks of threads, which prevents the entry of the corresponding reality. So if you can, you need not even do a lot of things. In fact, there are certain states which are so intense that within a second, your cobwebs can be loosened. It depends upon intensity. That is why the secret of yoga is develop intensity. Because intensity is the power of loosening very quickly. If the child really needs the mother's help and the child really weeps bitterly, intensely, the mother is bound to come. Even the lost mother can come, and that is possible because the intensity is so great. The threads immediately open out and call down the powers. In fact, that is the whole secret of the Veda. The whole world is nothing but a network of threads and relationships. And if you know the right way, even if you don't know the name, mere intensity is sufficient. And let that intensity of cry go forth. Even if you don't know the word Indra, Indra will come out. In that, you yourself will discover Indra. You don't need to read the Veda. That is why I said that Veda is not a book. Veda itself is an ocean of knowledge, which is already in the heart of everyone. You may not know it, but every one of us has internal Veda. As Sri Aurobindo says, the Shastra of integral yoga is the eternal Veda, which is already in the heart of every human being. It's already there. It is because we do not know how to open that internal book that you may need to open this outer book and you may find out the secrets. But even without it, you don't need to refer to that book of Veda in which all the mantras are given. You can even develop new mantras accordingly. And they will also be called Vedas. That is why it is called Anantaha Vedaha. Veda is not that four volumes. Anantaha Vedaha. The Vedas are infinite. Because according to the need of your being, you can just cry out and the real cry will take you to the right mantra by itself. You will be yourself drashta. You will yourself write a new mantra. That is also possible. But the Vedic rishis had done so much that they had discovered all this, they wrote down, and then told you that for connecting yourself with a particular power, you need to do such and such a sacrifice. If you want, for example, the aspiration to reach the highest point where the response of God can come to you very clearly, one of the things that is required is Ghritam Tivram. This is another secret of the Veda. Ghritam Tivram. Ghrita means the clarified butter. Tivram means absolutely refined. Now, Ghritam Tivram is actually a symbolic word which means clarified intelligence. If your aspiration is connected or is fueled by pouring into it clarified intelligence, in fact, all that we are now doing is a yajna of that kind. We are clarifying our intelligence. This is the process of Ghritam Tivram. We are doing Ghritam Tivram. So, if you put this Ghritam Tivram in our process of our aspiration, then the response will be much more clear, much more readily available. So, it is this kind of secret, this kind of sacrifice that we find in the Veda. It also tells you the period of sacrifice, intensity, the length, the duration, because you know that every intensity increases with duration. A pinch which is only for a second does not give you that much of pain, but the same pinch, if it lasts for 1 hour, it really intensifies itself and it becomes very painful or somewhat painful. So duration and intensity, both are necessary. But both these can be overcome. Actually, you don't even need either intensity or this if he himself is in need of you. It may be that in the work of God themselves, they need you. That is also possible.
Will that be? Will that be? That would make our work very easy.
That also would be possible. Like, for example, Parvati wanted Shiva very much. And she was doing all kinds of austerities. But Shiva was inaccessible. But the gods, they found it necessary to have one great warrior who can defeat all the demons. And as they looked around, made a survey, they found there is not a single one here. Then they came to the conclusion that only if Shiva and Parvati meet, then a child can be produced, Kumara Sambhava, then a child can be produced who will have that power by which the demons can be vanquished. Now here gods were in need. So they came in search of Parvati. They went to Kamadeva. They themselves arranged for Shiva's awakening from his meditation. He was disturbed. They had to sacrifice even Kamadeva's body in the meantime. And so Shiva opened his third eye, and the outer body of Kamadeva was burned to ashes. But Parvati herself was a beneficiary. Because of the needs of gods, she, who was doing tapasya for such a long time, was not able to fulfill herself. She got directly. So there can be also moments of that kind. So the point is that we need to prepare ourselves that we might be needed.
We have to become Parvati's.
That we might be needed. Very true. So keep yourself ready all the time. That is why one of the lessons of the yoga is kindle your light every day. Dive, dive. Every day, daily. And again and again. And every moment, in fact, that which is not lost at all. So if you keep yourself in that condition, you will be needed. And he will lift you up. It is because Arjuna was so dear to Sri Krishna that he lived with Sri Krishna all the time. That was his intensity. He prepared himself to be worthy of the company of Sri Krishna. Then he very wisely chose that Sri Krishna should be his sarathi, his charioteer. Therefore, automatically when he was in difficulty, Sri Krishna himself came forward and began to give him the knowledge, poured it on him, because he was needed by Sri Krishna himself. That if he did not fight, what about the consequences? He was so powerful an instrument that Sri Krishna came immediately and gave him the knowledge. In any case, this is the secret aspect of the Vedic knowledge, that it gives you the threads of the cosmos, the important knots of these threads, and how these threads can be related with. This is another synthesis that we find in the Veda. The synthesis of the human powers with the cosmic powers by means of invocation and means of sacrifice. And then finally, there is another point in the Veda, and that is the idea of perfectibility of man and attainment of immortality, amritam. These two important concepts the Veda gives, that when you synthesize yourself with gods and with the Supreme God and you become one, realize the Supreme, and put your body, life and mind in such a beautiful condition of preparedness and brightness and readiness, then you have perfection and immortality. Now, these are the aspects of the Vedic synthesis. Now, if you read with me four or five lines that Sri Aurobindo has written, they are the most difficult lines in that chapter to explain the Vedic synthesis on page number 7. On page number 7, there have been other syntheses in the long history of Indian thought. Page number 7. Is it? I'm sorry. Page number 9, is it? There have been other syntheses in the long history of Indian thought. We start with the Vedic synthesis of the psychological being of man in his highest flights and widest rangings of divine knowledge, power, joy, life and glory with the cosmic existence of the gods. Pursued behind the symbols of the material universe into those superior planes which are hidden from the physical sense and material mentality. The crown of this synthesis was in the experience of the Vedic rishis something divine, transcendent, not only cosmic but transcendent and blissful, in whose unity the increasing soul of man and the eternal divine fullness of cosmic Godheads meet perfectly and fulfill themselves. Now these are very difficult words, but maybe that with what I have said, it will become much more clear. The various kinds of perfections that I spoke of are all now summarized in these four lines. I shall read again. We start with the Vedic synthesis of the psychological being of man. That is, our powers of various kinds have to be developed. Then in its highest flights and widest rangings of divine knowledge, power, joy, life and glory, with the cosmic existence of the gods, which are pursued behind the symbols of the material universe. You speak the word Surya is a symbol, but actually it represents us Surya as a god, a cosmic god. It's not only this outer Surya which we see. So they are pursued behind the symbols of the material universe into those superior planes which are hidden from the physical sense and the material mentality. So yourself, uniting yourself with the cosmic gods and perfecting yourself by this connection. Now, the crown of the synthesis was in the experience of the Vedic rishis, something divine, transcendent and blissful. This is actually, Veda does not use the word Satchidananda, but these three words are used, divine, transcendent and blissful. So it is actually a translation of Satchidananda, in whose unity, that is, Satchidananda is also unity, in whose unity the increasing soul of man and the eternal divine fullness, perfection and immortality, increasing soul of man and the eternal divine fullness of the cosmic Godheads meet perfectly and fulfill themselves. The perfection of the gods attain a relationship with you and you become as perfect as the gods in each domain. Right? This is the, you might say, the synthesis that we find in the Veda. I think we can stop here now again, although I thought that I shall complete the whole paragraph today, but I went astray. I spoke at length on this thing which I thought we shall just pass over as introduction. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Those four lines are perhaps now better explained. So we shall continue now next time and we shall go to the synthesis of the Upanishads and then the synthesis of the Gita, then the synthesis of Tantra and then the nature of the synthesis that we are looking for in the new world. That will complete our first chapter.
That will complete the first chapter.
Huh?
That will complete the
first, only the first chapter. Because that is the whole page is so difficult. This page number 9 in your book is a very difficult page. Because it summarizes the entire history of Indian thought in a few lines. In those four lines on the Veda, they are summary of how many volumes? It's a kind of a quintessence of the whole Vedic domain is described here. So it is so difficult, so I have got to take some time with you and ask you to be patient with the first, this page itself.
When can we have?
I can tell you when I come